Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The 2011-2012 NBA season is in jeopardy. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest from the lockout front. Also, Esquire writer and Cleveland native Scott Rabb attempts to knock the crown from the head of King James, a trip through a NASCAR course involving suds and wax, and our listeners respond to our coverage last week of the Penn State scandal. Also ahead, orienteering.
You have a map and you have a compass, and it is your responsibility or your pleasure to figure out how to get from point A to point B, and then to point C, and then to point D, and then to point E.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, attorneys in central Pennsylvania reported that more alleged victims of former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky had come forward. One of those attorneys, Ben Andreazzi, has said he will have information on additional alleged victims next week. Current assistant coach Mike McQueary claimed in an email that he had notified police of his alleged discovery of Sandusky sexually abusing a 10-year-old boy in the showers at Penn State in 2002, though the authorities say they have no record of that. Yesterday, the NCAA announced an investigation of, quote, institutional control over the athletic programs at Penn State. Meanwhile, on Thursday night, ESPN reported that two men who had been ball boys for the men's basketball team at Syracuse University during the late 70s and 80s had accused longtime assistant coach Bernie Fine of sexually abusing them. Fine has been placed on administrative leave, though Syracuse head coach Jim Boeheim, citing an investigation which was dropped 6 years ago for lack of corroboration, has characterized the charges as lies. When I spoke last week with Charlie Pierce about the sexual abuse of children that had allegedly gone on at Penn State, he left no doubt about what he considered to be the story's core.
There is nothing here except the rape of children. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to talk about. Some coach's legacy, college football, I don't care about any of that. The rape of children is the only thing you should care about here. And if we haven't learned that after 20 years of covering this in the Catholic Church, I don't know when we ever will.
Charlie's comments generated a great deal of email and lots of Facebook posts. Laura Howitt wrote, "The fury in your voice and words echoed my anger. Thank you for your right-on commentary." Rand Robinson of Margate, Florida wrote, "Charlie's thoughts are spot on. It's about rape and molestation of children, plain and simple." And Michaela Sidori emailed to say she thought Charlie's comments were, quote, "totally appropriate, courageous, and thoughtful." In her email, Rebecca Latson of Angleton, Texas, referred to Charlie as, quote, "someone who actually sees and understands the real issue in the Penn State fiasco." Dr. Arthur Leifert, who hears Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio, also emailed us. In reference to Charlie's remarks, he wrote, "You said it all, the parallels with the church and reverence for the personality cults generated by some Division I football programs is pertinent. Thank you. Your words brought me to a saddened standstill." Among the many postings on our Facebook page was this one from Robert Erie. "I am not a Penn State fan, but I think Charlie Pierce's comments were sanctimonious and self-serving." Mr. Erie went on to accuse Charlie of, quote, "beating his favorite whipping boy, college athletics." You can reach us through onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. And you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Tomorrow, Major League Soccer's champion will be determined when the LA Galaxy and the Houston Dynamo meet at the Home Depot Center in Carson, California. The galaxy is, not surprisingly, studded with stars. David Beckham, Robbie Keane, and Landon Donovan. But the opposition must be doing something right. The Dynamo, just half a dozen years in Houston, are appearing in their third championship game. Joining me now to preview the MLS Cup is Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
David Beckham was named the league's comeback player of the year this week. He was certainly instrumental in getting L.A. into the final. Will he shine in what may be his last MLS game?
He certainly could. He's had a great playoff, perhaps the best player in these MLS playoffs, just delivering great crosses and passes all over the field. After having his best season in 5 years in MLS, he's been healthy all year. He hasn't been going on loan anywhere or playing for England. He's shown that he can still play at a pretty high level.
Both teams will be missing important players. Houston's Brad Davis is out with a torn quadricep. Chad Barrett of the Galaxy dislocated his ankle last week in training. Which team is better equipped to fill in gaps created by injuries?
Probably Los Angeles. Not only are they a bit deeper team, but losing Barrett, while not a good thing, he had 7 goals this year, isn't as tough as Houston losing Brad Davis, who's the second-place finisher in the MVP voting this year in MLS, led the league in assists ahead of David Beckham. So we'll see. But Houston actually won the semifinal without Brad Davis on the field for most of that game. I think Houston has a better chance in this game than most people give them, even though LA is still the favorite.
Referring to the structure of the MLS postseason, your Sports Illustrated colleague Steve Davis has called this year's playoffs, quote, the most nonsensical postseason to date. Do you agree with that characterization?
You know, it's unfortunate the way the MLS does its playoffs, because it's sort of a crapshoot. Anyone who gets into the playoffs, one of the 10 teams, has a chance at winning. And in several recent years, you felt like maybe the team that won didn't totally deserve it based on how they performed in a long regular season. At least this year, LA had the best regular season record in the league, and they're in the final. Houston did get hot at the end of the season and has played very well in the postseason. But the scheduling was odd because there was an international break for FIFA national team games, and so after playing 12 playoff games in 12 days, we've gone 2 weeks now without any MLS playoff games before the final. And while that may work for the Super Bowl, it's a little odd for soccer.
LA is playing on their home field, and they have not only Beckham, but Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan. Houston has the sort of motivation underdogs must depend on, and their coach, Dominic Kinnear, has a postseason record of 10-4-2. So who wins?
I like LA to win 2-1 in this game, but I'm hoping it's a good open game. Both these teams are very good defensively, so that may not be the case, but maybe an early goal could open things up. I think Houston deserves a ton of credit for getting here. It's kind of a clash of philosophies in this final. You've got the idea of paying a ton of money for your players like the Galaxy does with its stars, and Houston has opted to kind of keep things spread out and not have one guy making a lot more money than the rest. We've never seen a big money team win the championship in MLS, and this could be the first chance.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated, and he joins me here at Only a Game from time to time as well. Grant, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
The 2011 NASCAR Sprint Cup will be awarded tomorrow at Homestead Miami Speedway to Carl Edwards or to Tony Stewart, who are separated by only 3 points in the Cup Chase standings. But even after the season ends, NASCAR fans can show their love for the sport at one or two official NASCAR car washes. These are the first two of a planned chain, the latest move by NASCAR to expand its billion-dollar brand beyond bumper stickers and baby bibs. From Romeoville, Illinois, Yolanda Perdomo reports.
On a beautiful, sunny, late Sunday morning, a line of cars formed near a couple of fast food restaurants and across the street from a motel. Drivers wait their turn to go through the former Spotless Express, now known as the NASCAR Car Wash. A large sign with the NASCAR logo sits behind a checkered flag, and it's lit up as a beacon to this full-service operation, which also includes oil changes and detail work. Lester Cochran is the assistant manager.
I'd have to say, with us garnering the NASCAR logo, that our business has definitely picked up quite a bit. But, you know, with the NASCAR logo, it brings added incentives, a little bit more, you know, quality, bang for your buck type deal.
On average, 300 cars complete the dry and clean circuit at the NASCAR car wash during the week, while weekends see about 700. Dante Williams comes in twice a month with his SUV.
They're real quick, so I get my oil changed here, too.
Are you a NASCAR fan?
No, I'm not a NASCAR fan. It's just, well, I can watch it, but I just can't watch it long. Not much excitement to me, I guess. I just don't see nobody going around in circles.
For Adam Gowdy, the NASCAR brand is appealing enough to get him into the car wash, but not enough to get him to watch a race.
They lowered the full price, and also pretty much all their washes, they lowered the price of by at least a couple dollars. Not really. I've never been a fan of NASCAR. I mean, it's, you know, cars going around in a circle.
It's not your thing.
No, not my thing.
After more than an hour trying in vain to find a NASCAR fan at the NASCAR car wash, I turned to assistant manager Lester Cochran, who admits he wasn't a big NASCAR fan before the car wash's grand reopening in September. But since then, he's been on something of a fact-finding mission.
You know, I want to be able to, you know, if people sit down and have a conversation with me about certain drivers, I want to be able to answer the question. I don't want to sound like an idiot. So I mean, I'm a growing NASCAR fan. I wouldn't say I'm 100% of a NASCAR fan, but I'm a growing NASCAR fan.
The Quaker Steak and Lube in Portage, Indiana, isn't an official NASCAR establishment, but its tire tracks are all over it. Outside, a black and white Jim Beam car sits at the front door. Inside, framed race car uniforms and autographed driver photos are everywhere. A large model of a Dale Earnhardt Jr. car hangs over one of its bars. It's where fan Dan Stewart catches NASCAR races every week.
What I like about it, you don't see them on strike because they're crying about their pay. They're broken link, or they don't do nothing. You don't see nothing about NASCAR, bitch about their pay. They go out there and race for a purse, whatever it is. It could be $1 million or it could be $200,000. They go out and do it every week.
Darren Marshall thinks the establishment of new NASCAR-branded business won't be enough on its own to keep old fans around and bring in new ones. He's the senior vice president of Revolution, a Chicago-based sports marketing firm.
I think the way that they attract new fans from outside their current demographic is to have drivers who become successful from those demographics. And a lot of that is to do with their challenges in appealing to Hispanic Americans and African Americans who are, you know, making up an increasing proportion of the population.
Colombian Formula One driver Juan Pablo Montoya is now a NASCAR driver. Indy favorite Danica Patrick joined NASCAR in 2010 and moves up to its Sprint Cup Series next year. NASCAR Vice President Blake Davidson says their Drive for Diversity program is opening their sport to a new demographic. I asked Davidson if, given the general apathy I encountered in Romeoville, the idea to create a chain of car washes is missing the mark.
If we can make a connection there and they remember the NASCAR name later in their day or that weekend or whenever it is, you know, that jogs a memory, hey, I went to the NASCAR car wash, then that's helpful. And hopefully, again, they'll want to watch the race or go to a race one day.
Back at the car wash, it's business as usual. Dirty cars in, shiny cars out. In the meantime, NASCAR is planning its next business venture, a NASCAR theme park for kids that just might be roaring into a town near you. For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. This week, LeBron James was at the London School of Basketball for a Nike promotion, and a reporter asked him who would win a one-on-one matchup between James and Kobe Bryant. "I'm not going to not take myself against anybody," James said. Hack your way through that knot of knots, and that means James thinks he would win. Last year, Kobe Bryant was asked the same question. He said he'd win. "Hey, guys, there's a lockout. There's no NBA season. Why not just do it?" Wait, the London School of Basketball? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the book LeBron James wishes Scott Rabb hadn't written. But first, On Thursday afternoon, Oklahoma State University women's basketball coach Kurt Budke and his assistant Miranda Serna were killed when the private plane in which they were traveling crashed near Perryville, Arkansas. It was the second time the Oklahoma State community had suffered such a loss. In 2001, 10 men affiliated with the university's men's basketball team died in a plane crash. University President Burns Hargis celebrated Kurt Budke as, quote, an exemplary leader, and Miranda Serna as, quote, an outstanding role model. Oklahoma State canceled the team's game scheduled for this weekend. The NBA, I'm sad to say, there's little to report. What happens next will probably be determined in a court, and not a court surrounded by a crowd both loud and large, but one in which a judge, and not a ref, will be in charge. Joining me now to discuss the likelihood that we'll see even a much abbreviated NBA season is Sports Illustrated Sam Amick. Sam, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me.
David Stern briefed the owners yesterday on the current situation, but the league has not said when it might next return to negotiations. Are talks likely to resume soon?
I don't see it as likely, Bill. I think right now the owners seem pretty inclined to go backwards with their offer. I think their view on this is the players took a drastic move, and it's not going to cause the owners to blink, so it's not looking good.
Earlier this week, Commissioner Stern announced there would be no games before December 15th, and of course there's speculation now the whole season may be in jeopardy. Is that your take on it?
It is. I mean, the waters are murky right now, Bill, but the reality is these guys are not sitting at the table. The games are falling off the docket. And, again, the fact that the players caught the owners off guard with a legal route that you can call it bold, you can call it ill-advised, but the owners, I don't think, are going to improve the offer. And really, right now, that's the only way this season takes place.
The legal move to which you referred, of course, is the NBA Players Association decertified, and two groups of players have filed antitrust suits, one in California, one in Minnesota, against the league. What was the reasoning behind those moves?
The union essentially reached a point where they felt as if the owners were done negotiating. They were getting fairly close to an agreement, but then the league and David Stern essentially said, this is going to be it. This is our last best offer, and if you decline this one, then it's going to go backwards, and it's going to be 47% for the players. The union, in response, essentially said, you're not acting, negotiating in good faith. We're going to take you to court. They're rolling the dice. They're seeking treble damages that nobody has ever successfully reached in a pro sports lawsuit. I don't think the odds are good, but that's the route they're taking.
The two sides were reported to be close to an agreement on the split of basketball-related income before the owners issued their ultimatum. So what are the issues still causing the current impasse?
The players think that the current proposal is far too restrictive to player movement. They want, in essence, more freedom than they're being offered in the current deal. Another significant aspect is the argument over the escrow system and the fact that the way the owners want to do it is to have an unlimited escrow system that, in essence, protects them from any bad decisions they make. If they spend too much money on players, they can backdoor the entire thing and dip into the players' pool to cover those losses. And so, I think all the way through this proposal, the players just feel like the debt is expected to come off on their backs. They're supposed to give this money back, and that the owners, they want complete cost certainty and they're not taking any risk at all in this current proposal.
The first court hearing is scheduled for March the 9th, which would seem to leave a lot of time between now and then for a resolution. Would it be in the best interest of all concerned to avoid what is certain to be a very long legal process?
Without question. I mean, that's the frustrating part for the fans and the media covering this, is this stuff, the issues being argued over are complex. What's not complex is the money being lost and the fact that the odds are very slim, if not impossible, that both sides eventually get a deal that puts them in a better spot than getting on the floor right now would with the proposal that that they had on the table previously. Hmm. They're losing about $200 million a month on each side. That's obviously money they're never going to get back. So it's one of those things, unfortunately, where I think that, call it ego, call it emotion, other things have come into play here that have, you know, put the situation where it is, and common sense is not ruling the day.
Last week, the players missed a paycheck for the first time since the lockout began. Does that change anything?
You would think it would, but what I'm hearing and sensing right now is that at least, I would say, for the next month, maybe 6 weeks, I get the sense that the players are not going to fold or cave or, you know, go that route, which a lot of people had assumed that once the checks, you know, stopped coming, that's what would take place. These guys obviously make a lot of money. Just to give people an idea, it was reported the other day that, you know, LeBron James' first check was over $1 million, that's money he'll never get back. You know, Dirk Nowitzki, you know, the MVP of the NBA Finals, was around $700,000. So at some point, I think that crunch and that factor does come into play, but I think that it doesn't come into play yet. The players have different funds that came their way at the end of last season that I think are keeping them from panicking just yet.
With the most recent breakdown in negotiations, there have been rumors of more top-level players heading overseas, the latest among them being Kevin Durant. Is this what the league had in mind a few years ago when the commissioner said he wanted to expand across the globe?
I'm not going to speak for the commissioner. I probably not. I don't think that's what he had in mind. You know, it does speak to the global popularity of the game that there is so much interest, and there are teams overseas that are very excited about possibly signing these guys. You know, Deron Williams has been playing in Turkey for a couple of months, the New Jersey Nets point guard, and Kevin Durant is talking to a number of teams, possibly going to Germany. But no, it's not only not what David Stern envisioned, but it's a short-term solution, and it's not even a solution for the players. It's a stopgap that probably about 10% of the league will be successfully able to, you know, to get a job overseas and not feel the sting of this lockout. But the jobs are not nearly aplenty enough. And on top of that, at this late date, a lot of those teams have their seasons well underway. So I think some of the stars are going to have opportunities, but most of the guys won't.
Sam Amick writes about pro basketball for Sports Illustrated. Sam, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Regarding LeBron James, Esquire writer-at-large Scott Rabb will never be accused of not saying what he thinks. His new book, subtitled One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James, is titled The Whore of Akron. As far as Rabb is concerned, James is, quote, a hideously poor sportsman who stomped on Cleveland's soul and cracks, breaks, and falls apart in the games that matter most. Scott Rabb joins me now from WCPN in Cleveland. Scott, welcome to Only a Game.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
You write at length about the pain that you have endured as a fan of Cleveland's teams. Was it masochism that led you to write a book about LeBron James?
I think not. I think it was pride. I think part of the experience of being a sports fan in Cleveland, rooting for teams that have really, they've failed in the most spectacular ways, it's not masochistic. It's the kind of tempering, the steel-tempered, you know, the strength that you derive from being that kind of fan. I know it sounds overstated and almost snide, but I think it's true. When it finally does happen here, when we finally do have that championship parade, it'll mean more to these folks, to me, to us, than it could possibly mean anywhere else in the country.
Well, that's precisely the next thing that I want to get to, because regarding LeBron James's final season with the Cavaliers, you maintained that you didn't care that he would probably leave after that season. You wrote, all they have to do is win and everything else will take care of itself. What would have happened if Cleveland had won it all in 2010?
Had LeBron fulfilled the mission, And it was something that he claimed as his mission, not to go chasing championships, but to bring one to a fan base that he understood firsthand. He grew up around here. If he had left at that point, there would be sadness, but there would be no sense of betrayal. There would be no outrage.
This book is as much about you as it is about LeBron James, I think. And at one point you write that, quote, being Jewish and being a Cleveland sports fan have always felt to me like the same thing. Explain that for us.
I think both are core parts of my identity. Both seem to me to be legacies rather than choices. And I think although you can make too much of either one, the suffering involved, I think— there is an aspect of being the chosen, so-called chosen people. I think the punchline is, God, choose someone else for a change. And I think for Cleveland sports fans who have internalized this woe and who think of themselves as singled out, in the same way Job perhaps was singled out, they are inextricably entwined to me.
The sporting press comes in for some serious criticism, too, especially ESPN. What's your problem with the alleged worldwide leader?
They talk a lot about multi-platform entertainment, sports, and news. The truth of the matter is when you have one entity, a quasi-journalistic entity, business partnering with the league, with certain teams, you have athletes who are paid tens of millions of dollars per year by sponsors whose products are sold on the network at another cost. While all that is going on, to say that we also have honest, credible, straight-shooting journalists who are going to dig deep in order to perhaps expose some of the flaws in the game or in a particular athlete, I don't think it's credible journalism. Giving LeBron James that hour of prime time as if they weren't colluding in one athlete's quest for a championship, quest for maximizing his income, all those things, and then to turn around and pour an extraordinary amount of money, an extraordinary amount of talent into what they called the Heat Index, where one team suddenly became co-branded with ESPN. I know I was hard on ESPN. I'm hardly alone.
Of course, the Heat did not win the NBA championship last spring. The promises and mission of LeBron James to the contrary, they lost in part because James was ineffective in the games that counted most when Miami played the Mavericks in the finals. That must have been satisfying to you, but would the book have been even more splendidly venomous if James and company had won it all?
I fully expected him to rise up, have the two best games of his career, and for the Heat to walk away with the NBA crown. I think you're being kind. I think LeBron, in four consecutive finals games, choked his entire team into defeat. And you don't have to be a Clevelander or a Cleveland Cavaliers fan to recognize under that kind of pressure, he cracked and he broke. And to say that I wasn't thrilled by that would be a lie. I rooted with all my heart for him to succeed for 7 years, and he failed at that. And having had the experience of rooting for him to fail and see him succeed wildly at failure, it felt great. I got to say, Schadenfreude, the Germans have to have a better word than Schadenfreude for something that public and that wonderful.
You conclude that Miami is the perfect place for LeBron James to showcase his talents because, and I can't help myself, I'm quoting again here, there is no home and there are no fans. at what point did that occur to you?
Early in the season, when they devoted two prime pages of their game program to what they called Fan Up Miami! Exclamation point. And here, in essence, was a two-page manual for sports fans about how to be sports fans. Get to your seat on time.
Stay until the end of the game.
No, I mean literally, those pages could have been sold for advertising, but they were embarrassed. They found it necessary. And to be fair, the atmosphere in that arena, and I like the city of Miami, you know, it's a party. They are not that focused. For better and for worse, they're just not going to care as much as Rust Belt fans who don't think about fun in the sun. They think about, let's go in there and watch our boys kick butt. But to see this in the program, just, and this is where the kid wants to play? It was tragic in a way.
Scott, having written The Horror of Akron, have you gotten LeBron James out of your system?
I'll know for sure if and when they resume play and I watch him take the court again in a Heat uniform. But honestly, the process of writing the book helped a lot. It helped me come to terms with some of – I had never asked myself what made me the kind of fanatic that would wish for a career-ending injury. And I know how stark that sounds, and people have really singled that line out as if I'm some monster. But I really did want to answer that question. It's something when people say, yeah, it's only sports. there's an aspect to it of war. And I don't think that's simply some intellectual contrivance. I think that's very real. It may be gender specific, and it may be more true in an embittered Rust Belt town. But there is something about the passion that sports fans bring to the game and for rooting for their team that is pretty raw, pretty primitive.
Scott, I've watched the video of you delivering a copy of The Whore of Akron to Maverick Carter, who sort of runs LeBron James, Inc. Did you ever get any response from LeBron James or LeBron James, Inc. to the book?
No, I dropped a copy off also at LeBron's mansion in Bath, Ohio. In both cases, I inscribed the book with sincere gratitude for making this book possible. I know it seems almost sardonic to sign it that way. I haven't gotten any responses. I would assume I'm not going to get any responses, but I would love the chance. People say, well, you certainly wouldn't call him a whore if you were in the same room. I wouldn't start the conversation that way. Absolutely not. But I would love to have that conversation because I think, and the lockout really goes a long way to show it, there's very little concern for the fans. Between the players and the owners, there are no good guys. What they've made clear beyond anything else is they really don't care about the fans. They care enormously about the money. But when it comes to actually playing, fans are the least of their concern.
Scott Rabb is the author of The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. The book is published by Harper, and the author joined me from WCPN in Cleveland. Scott, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks so much.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
2 years ago, a couple of scouts for fabled Premiership side Manchester United spotted a prospect in nearby Denton. Charlie Jackson dazzled the team's coaches with his back heels and various other soccer tricks. Unhappily for those envisioning immediate stardom for the lad, Charlie Jackson was only 3 years old. League rules mandated that he couldn't train at Man U's development center until he was five. Now Charlie's time has come, and Manchester United has scooped him up, which, according to Charlie's dad, is not such a good thing after all. He really didn't want to go, said Andy Jackson. He's really anti-United. Eventually, I had to say to him, look, we'll let United train you up, and then when you're really good, you can go to Manchester City. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, running with maps. Sounds much safer than running with scissors. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in Mississippi this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
You're on the record as saying Penn State would be wise to consider canceling football for a while. After last Saturday's game between Penn State and Nebraska, Nebraska head coach Bo Pelini said he didn't think that game should have been played. Thoughts?
It's hard to know what he was doing. I mean, he did go in and get himself a win, which is a good thing for him. But, I mean, I would imagine that it was a terribly odd atmosphere around the game. And being the visiting team must have been strange in and of itself. So I guess I'm not surprised that he would react that way.
Syracuse put assistant men's basketball coach Bernie Fine on administrative leave after new allegations that he molested a ball boy. The accuser tells ESPN that Fine touched him inappropriately back in the 80s and 90s. Syracuse head coach Jim Boeheim says the allegations are false. The accuser is trying to capitalize on the Penn State scandal in order to make money. Is Syracuse handling this correctly so far?
Syracuse is. I don't know that Jim Boeheim is. Jim Boeheim should shut his pie hole on this issue, because if it turns out to be true, he's going to look like a jackass. Anybody who thought Penn State was a one-shot was sadly mistaken. The Citadel thing broke almost immediately afterwards. And there are a lot of coaches out there coaching a lot of children in a lot of AAU basketball. And if I had to guess, I would guess that's where the next shoe was going to drop.
On Tuesday, two groups of NBA players filed antitrust lawsuits against the league. On Thursday, the league updated its owners in a 20-minute conference call that apparently included no discussion of future strategy or scheduling of future meetings. I don't know about you, but that sounds to me like a bad sign.
Well, it's in the hands of the lawyers now, so you can forget about any possible resolution till at least Christmas. I've come all the way around to the thinking that we are not going to have an NBA season this year. I don't see the two sides reconciling their differences at all. I think, you know, we have now passed into the netherworld of management intransigence. And it's to everyone's benefit to remember that a lockout is always a management strategy.
Well, Charlie, at least one person disagrees with you and still has hope. 76ers head coach Doug Collins has not yet booked his flight to spend Thanksgiving in Hawaii with his family because he is still hopeful that, quote, there is going to be NBA basketball. I think it might be time for Coach Collins to call his travel agent. What do you think?
I think it's time to book the flight. By the way, Thanksgiving in Hawaii? Macadamia nut stuffing.
College basketball has a new, quote, winningest coach. Does Mike Krzyzewski's assumption of that title mean that we can talk about Bob Knight less than ever before?
Well, we could certainly talk about his place in the game a little bit less than we could before. Krzyzewski's going to put this record so far out of reach that I doubt very seriously that anybody will catch him.
My favorite headline this week reads, quote, Major League Baseball strike/lockout ends after negative 24 days. Baseball's new collective bargaining agreement will reportedly be announced on Monday. The old one was good until December 11th. What was the rush?
They really didn't want to see headlines that read, Major League Baseball nearing lockout, which is exactly what they would have gotten if they let it go any further.
This is really a way to stick a thumb in the eye of the NBA, isn't it? We'll fix
it. Really
we'll
is,
come
yeah.
to terms.
We're baseball. We've been screwing up our labor management since before there was an NBA, and we can do it.
Meanwhile, the sale of the Houston Astros has been finalized, as has the agreement to send that team to the American League. The move will also add two more wild card teams to the playoffs. People in Houston seem less than enthusiastic, but are these good moves by Major League Baseball?
Well, I can tell you from not being in Boston this week and being out in the world, this is being treated as the Boston Red Sox Protection Act of 2011, these new playoff teams.
I mean, maybe if we move it down one more slot, the Red Sox will make the playoffs no matter
how
bad they are.
That's exactly right. The absence of the Red Sox in last year's playoffs has been noted. So anyway, they're going to have to eat. They're going to have to drink a lot of beer and eat a lot of fried chicken to miss the playoffs next year.
Dale Swaim is the new manager of the Chicago Cubs. According to ESPN, the Cubs went for, quote, the baseball guy instead of the biggest name available. Gee, you think the new manager feels better or worse about his new challenge after that?
Well, I mean, the big name guy was also probably more pronounceable than Dale Swaim. How he gets Swaim out of that, I will never know. He was a hot commodity. The Red Sox really entertained the idea of hiring him, too. Now he's decided to go to a franchise with a sad and glorious history of losing whose fans are not quite as indulgent as the ones in Boston.
The Denver Broncos are now 4-1 with Tim Tebow as quarterback. Playing the Jets on national TV on Thursday night, Tebow looked awful for 54 minutes, and then he won the game. Or was he just lucky?
He's just lucky that they've built a heck of a defense out there, basically. I am not going to go into all he does is win camp yet. He's not an NFL quarterback. He may never be an NFL quarterback. They can gimmick up their offense for a while, but sooner or later, they're going to have to draft a real quarterback out there.
How, H-O-W-E, do you feel about the new class of Hockey Hall of Famers?
Well, first of all, there's never been a more Canadian-named class of hockey players. We have Doug Gilmour with a U, Eddie Belfour with a U, and then we have Joe Nieuwendyk, who has lots of U's and Y's and K's and is probably right up there with Krzyzewski and Swaim in terms of our new feature here on Only a Game, Sports Pronunciation 101. I'm really happy for Mark Howe. His father, Gordy, looked overjoyed at the ceremony. And it really does sort of put another ornament on what is really kind of a lovely family story.
The LA Galaxy team that plays the Houston Dynamo for Major League Soccer's championship tomorrow will feature the league's comeback player of the year. Anybody you've heard of?
Actually, it is. It's David Beckham.
Yes, indeed.
Now, let me say something here, and I know it's going to sound unkind, but everybody in the world of elite soccer thinks David Beckham is over the hill, right? What does he say that he's the MVP of the league in the United States?
No, he's the comeback player
of the year.
He's old, but he still
can. Okay, that's the living definition of washed up in athletics, Bill.
And finally, Charlie, I hope you were watching the Bills-Cowboys game last weekend because it featured the latest brave blow against the No Fun League struck by a player. Tell us about what Bills receiver David Nelson did with the football after he'd caught a touchdown pass.
Well, apparently he's involved in a romance with one of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. And after scoring the touchdown, he ran all the way around the field to give his girlfriend the trophy of his success, the football. And good for him.
Charlie Pierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill. Cheerleader, your sweet dreamer. Sweet cheerleader, my little hometown girl. You're my hometown.
With the holiday season almost upon us, you might soon be heading over the river and through the woods. If someone comes sprinting out of the brush along the way, don't worry. It's probably just an orienteer. Only a Game's Doug Travoux recently attended the U.S. National Orienteering Championships, and he has our story.
Finding a good spot for an orienteering course can be complicated. Mapping it can be complicated. Setting up equipment to record times, complicated. But Gary Kraft of Mill Valley, California, says the sport's premise is pretty simple.
You have a map and you have a compass, and it is your responsibility or your pleasure to figure out how to get from point A to point B, and then to point C, and then to point D, and then to point E.
On this bright, cool Saturday in late October, orienteers have gathered in the Lynn Woods in Lynn and Saugus, Massachusetts, for the U.S. Orienteering National Middle Distance Championships. It's part of a three-day event that also includes sprint and long-distance races at other courses in Greater Boston. Lisa Carr traveled from Dallas.
I've never been here before, so this is going to be true orienteering. It's not my familiar home terrain. That's why we like to travel. Golfers like to travel to different golf courses they never played, and for orienteers, it's the same way with terrain. We're excited when there's a new map, a new area we can explore.
There are several overlapping courses set up for different age groups and experience levels. Carr and other veteran orienteers will be on the one that's about 4 kilometers long with 13 checkpoints known as controls.
So it's like a 3D puzzle while I'm out there. And, you know, it's even better than a maze because I'm not funneled from one direction to the other. It's my choice where I go, and it's my choice when I mess up. So I feel this real sense of accomplishment, you know, when I get there and I find the control where I thought it would be. You know, it's kind of a rush. You get addicted to that feeling.
Cambridge, Massachusetts residents Larry and Sarah Mae Berman founded the Cambridge Sports Union in 1962 as a running club. They added orienteering after learning about it in the early 70s. Larry says it was an adjustment.
I was always running faster than I could navigate. Over the years, I gradually learned how to navigate better. But of course, over the years, I gradually learned to run slower.
The CSU spent months organizing this event. An orienteering map is far more detailed than a standard topographical map, and the group hired an expert to fill in specifics like large boulders, stone walls, and small streams. Berman says those elements are critical.
In your mind, you have a picture. You say, well, in about 50 yards, I pass a big rock, and in another 30 yards, there's another rock, and the control flag that I need to find is on the other side of that rock. Of course, if the flag isn't there, you say, oh, they put it in the wrong place. But of course, they didn't. You made a mistake.
Sneaking a peek at the course would spoil the fun, so the registration area is far removed from the start, about a 15-minute hike that ends on top of a rock outcropping where racers do a second check-in.
I'm not taking anybody's map. 12:21.
The starting point is 20 yards away, but even here, it's hidden from view. U.S. Orienteering President Peter Goodwin.
I can see where they start from, but I can't see where they run. So there's no advantage to me to say, oh, the person on my course went that way, so therefore I can just follow which way they go. I have to look at my map and say, oh, I guess I better go a particular way.
The individual starts are spaced out. Starter Peter Lane hands the orienteer the appropriate 8.5 by 11 inch map face down, then sends him off.
3, 2, 1, go.
I assume that it would be against protocol for anybody to try and pry you for advice off the line here.
They can ask, but I have not seen the maps.
You're around the maps the whole time, but you haven't taken a look.
I have not looked at the maps.
Competitors are looking for orange and white nylon markers on short stakes. When they find the right control, they punch a small electronic chip worn on one finger into a reader. After the race, they'll be able to see their split times from point to point. Standing out on the course, there are long moments of complete silence. Then an orienteer bursts into view, racing to the next control. The championships have attracted about 300 people from all over the country. Although anyone can orienteer, many participants have backgrounds in science, engineering, or math. Allison Crocker is an astrophysics researcher at UMass Amherst. She's also the top female orienteer in the U.S. and went on to sweep all three events.
It's so much more than just running. Do I want to go over that hill? Do I want to go around it? Should I cross the stream now or further up? Are there cliffs in my way? What do I do? So you end up running really hard for a full hour and you don't even know you've done it because you've been thinking so hard about how to get to the next place the whole time.
The sport is more popular in Europe than the United States and has a loyal following in Canada. Eric Kemp is from Ottawa, Ontario. The 21-year-old says even with maps, orienteers can lose their way.
You can get really lost. Once you sort of get to the elite level of orienteering, that happens less and less. Ideally, never. But there are varying degrees of sort of lostness. We joke that an orienteer never gets lost, they just get disoriented.
Orienteering is a solitary sport, but 11-time national champion Sharon Crawford of Frisco, Colorado, says one of the best parts is analyzing the race with friends.
And you talk with them, you said, gee, you know, I had no trouble with number 2, but I sure wobbled at 3, I overshot it, I had to circle back. How did you find it? Your friend will say, oh, gee, you made a mistake there, that was trivial. But number 5, I couldn't find it.
Peter Gagarin of Sunderland, Massachusetts, has been racing since 1973. The former national champion and U.S. team coach says something about the sport speaks to human nature.
There's always a sense of adventure, which is something that I think is missing too often in life. What's it going to be like this time? How am I going to do? And sometimes you do well, and sometimes it humbles you. But just the sense of newness each time is a wonderful thing.
Exploring the wilderness has timeless appeal, and today's youngest orienteers were just 9 years old. The oldest was 84. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
From my conversation a few minutes ago with Scott Rabb, the author of The Whore of Akron, you might have gotten the impression that Rabb is a bitter fellow, given to sulking and venomous attacks. It's a characterization even Rabb himself might not deny, though it's incomplete. Certainly he has made art of his rage against what is hollow and phony about the NBA in general, and James in particular, but at several luminous moments in the book, Rabb gratefully acknowledges his blessings. He is astonished again and again by his wife's kindness, and of his young son he writes, "This boy, this miracle, to become a father at the age of 47 is to know how close I came to missing out altogether, to never knowing how much I could love and how much I could be loved." Especially in this hyperbolic chronicle of the desperate misery of Cleveland fans and the personal umbrage Rabb takes at the feckless narcissism of his nemesis, these passages glow. Scott Rabb's own physical miseries, mistreatment by various authority figures, and insults real and imagined, it's all more extreme than most of us will know, and thank goodness for that. But Rabb is also determined, even in the teeth of the storm, especially in the teeth of the storm, to remind us of all there is to love and celebrate. In the context of sports, we've lately been bombarded with accounts of the alleged sexual abuse of children and personal and institutional irresponsibility so sickening that we turn to stories of the NBA lockout for relief. For those of us in the business of games, it feels a little ironic that it's coming up to traditional time for counting blessings. But on Thursday, I'll sit at a table with family that I love and friends I treasure, and I will think with gratitude about the extraordinary people with whom I get to work, and the wise and funny people I get to meet, and the books I get to read, and, of course, the games I get to watch in the context of this alleged work. I hope you will be similarly engaged in the celebration of those you cherish and of whatever else encourages you to look forward to the next day. Happy Thanksgiving. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guide. We had help this week from Jeff Carlton at WCPN in Cleveland and from Andy Harper at Ole Miss. Special thanks to Lakeshore Public Radio in Merrillville, Indiana. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Doug Trabu's orienteering photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Horror of Akron author Scott Rabb. I asked him if the critics had been harsh.
I gotta say, the most scathing review I've received so far is from my mom.
Ah, well, maybe she has a future as a book reviewer for The Plain Dealer. Give him heck, Lucille. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.